The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hello, my name's James Wrigley. I'm a financial advisor and one of the principals of Melbourne-based financial planning firm First Financial. I've been a long-term listener and contributor to the Ensemble Group and podcast, picking up some amazing nuggets of gold over the years. And through this podcast and the people that I'm able to speak to and interview, hopefully I can continue to deliver some of those nuggets of gold to you.
Ascender believes underwriting shouldn't slow down the advice process. With their industry-first digital PMARs, doctors complete smart online questionnaires that flow straight into Ascender's underwriting rules engine. Automated decisioning reduces friction and speeds up the approval process to help keep your business moving. On average, advisors are seeing 10-day faster decision times. It's a simpler, smarter way to write business and secure cover for your clients sooner. Visit ascender.com.au or call 136522.
Hello, welcome back to the podcast. We've got the rescheduled chat with Cathy Keys today. Thank you for joining me again, and apologies to say it on the podcast. I said it to you earlier, but apologies for the complete and utter mix-up earlier in the week when we were supposed to be chatting. So thanks for joining me again.
You're welcome. It's school holidays. Everything goes.
Yeah. Now, Cathy, you're at Pollock Financial, one of the advisors there. We'll get to have a bit of a chat about kind of Pollock and your role and so forth. In a minute, but you've been in financial advice for seven years. What's the time frame into financial advice now?
My career changed at the start of 2018.
Yep.
And probably spent about 12 months trying to go from the greenest person ever to having some understanding of what was going on.
Yeah.
So 12 months doing administration, power planning, client support, everything. And then jumped on the register like a lot of other people in that December of 2018 before the cutoff. And so have been in the advice space since then. So what did that make us? Six years or so?
Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, it's a new thing for me. But definitely can see a lot of benefits from a lifestyle and also, you know, where I wanted to go in my career rather than, you know, the path that I was on.
Yeah. Had you had any exposure to financial advice prior to the decision to make the career change? Or how did that all come about?
So my first boss at my previous company, he was actually my financial advisor.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I met him, I'm going to say probably around 2013 when I bought my home. And, you know, I'd see him every 12 months. We'd have a chat, you know, how's my super going? Yep. Okay, cool. All good. And our conversations leading up to, you know, 2016, 2017 had more been about he was wanting to understand the work that I was doing at that time. And that was I was working with a lot of doctors in an insurance space. And he wanted to understand how he could get into those avenues to get into those clients. And eventually I kind of went back to him and said, well, I've got all the contacts in that space. How about you employ me?
Yeah.
And I'll get you into a hospital was in the area and get you some young doctors as clients. And he said, sure, but to do that, you also have to become an advisor. So it was a decision I haven't regretted, but it was a decision that was made in a very short time frame with very little understanding of what had happened through the Royal Commission, very little understanding of the education requirements that I was about to head into. So I was a little probably naive around the actual role that an advisor did.
Yeah, right.
I was like, hey, I can talk to people. That's all I need to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
And for the most part, that gets me, you know, 80 to 90% of the way. But obviously the technical knowledge definitely, it's still being built upon to this day.
I don't think you ever stop learning, do you? There's always something new that you're learning.
I think that was the biggest thing is that every day, even though you've been through the scenario before with a client, the way it comes across or the way you talk about it is going to be different. So even though the scenario looks the same, each client's got their own nuances and goals. So yes, you're learning every day about how to talk to them, how to answer the questions the right way so they understand. So yeah, you're right. Every day is learning, and that's the journey we're all on.
Yeah.
And that, so you had some involvement around doctors and hospitals and things. Like, what were you doing before you got into financial advice? What was that job?
I was a business development manager for a medical indemnity company. They insure doctors for any, you know, lawsuits that come about in regards to their practice.
Yep.
I've been working in that space for probably about 12 years before I changed. So I had a lot of connection, a lot of networks that, you know, a lot of people will be more than happy to use. And that's what, you know, they were looking for. They wanted to get into that space.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. We, you know, I left my job about 3 months later, popped up at my previous firm and was contacting all my contacts going, hey, can we come in and see you and bring you lunch or morning tea or access to doctors? And they're like, Kathy, we'll have you back. We've missed you. So we would be out in the hospital, you know, once a month or so, trying to generate business in that, you know, younger doctor space.
And so have you built up a bit of a niche in that space then in the years since? Like how's it panned out?
I had until coming to Pollock. So yeah, that had definitely built up, you know, a following of doctors who, no, not only people who I knew, but people who referred in that space as well. I definitely went into it knowing that there were other quite big firms who had a bit of a stranglehold on that network. And I went in somewhat wanting to disrupt that because so many people thought that was the only option that they had. And I didn't really think that that was the right thing for the industry, that, you know, certain firms were portraying that they were the only option for that niche space.
Yeah.
I think I disrupted, opened people's eyes to other options. But you've also got to balance how much money gets used to try and access those networks. And of course, being a small firm, we didn't have the fun that some of the bigger guys do. You kind of take what you get. And after a couple of years, we wound that back and just, you know, kept working on the network that we'd already built and using our current clients to expand that.
Yeah.
Reading compliance activities can feel tedious, but now those activities can count as verified CPD. Go to cpdcheck.com and upload a recent email to earn points for your learning.
So what was the, you kind of got on the advisor register before a lot of the big changes that have happened in more recent years, but you still would have had to have gone through a bit of an education journey. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like for you?
Yeah, the first 12 months, so 2018, I did my diploma. So I did 3 of the 4 subjects because that's all we needed under the licensee we were at the time. And then as soon as 2019 hit, I actually decided to just roll straight into the grad dip and start ticking it off because I had never imagined that I would be going back to postgraduate studies in my mid-30s. It wasn't on my radar. It probably wasn't something that I was going to be like, I'm going to do this and this is, you know, I have to study. Like, it wasn't a passion project for me to be studying, but I knew that that's, one, what I needed to be a better advisor, and 2, obviously, that what the industry needed to, you know, call itself a profession.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
2019 kept going. Obviously, 2020, we changed licensees right as COVID hit. They had different requirements. So I actually had to go back to do a grad dip. Sorry, got back to do a diploma subject. So the 4th one. They also needed me to be tax registered as well. So I had to do that subject. So even though I did the exam, I think it was February 2020, there was probably 6 months there between March and September in 2020 where I couldn't give advice.
Yeah, right.
Because I couldn't get registered with the new licensee and their different requirements. So it was a bit of a strange time because I'd spent 12 months.
You had been advising and then you're told you couldn't have. How did you manage and how did the business manage during that time before all of a sudden one of the advisors can't advise?
Look, and it was difficult for everyone for that 6 months because COVID hit.
Yes, true.
So everyone's trying to scramble and figure out what's going on. We also had insurance changes happening at that time as well. So there was so much happening that we really just worked in a space of I was a conduit to the client, and any advice that would be needed was that my boss at the time would zoom in to prevent the advice. So I was really working, you know, basically as an associate role for that 6 months and scrambling, you know, calling tax practitioner board saying, have you got this? What do I need to give you? You know, I need this to happen as quickly as possible. You know, even getting, you know, result statements out of Kaplan that take, they're not quick. And you're like, I need this because without this, I can't progress to get tax practitioner board. I can't get back on the register. Like it was just, it was a strange time for everybody. But yeah, I had a few extra hurdles.
It's interesting.
That time.
It's interesting you did the kind of those first four subjects and then you've rolled on to continue to do the next four. Like I know so many others that have done that or you know, wherever they were working, they might have had to have done the eight and then they've done the eight and they're like, you know what, I'm just going to do these last four and then I've got the masters. It's funny that it seems so daunting to start it in the first place, but once you've done four or once you've done eight, you're like, oh, well, I may as well just keep doing these last few and then I can tick that box too. So you're one of those people.
I was just like, let's just get it done. I'm not a person to leave it to the last minute. I didn't want to be in a position where I was overlapping subjects to get through it. I was quite lucky in that I actually only worked a 9-day fortnight during the 12-week period that my subjects were on.
Yeah, right.
So I would work 5 days a week, you know, study, you know, 2 half days over the weekend. And then I'd have, you know, one Monday a fortnight where I'd be doing all of my life admin because I just didn't have capacity to, you know, do study. You know, I'd be doing 5 or 6 hours each day on the weekend just to be getting ahead and keeping up. So I'm very lucky that I had a boss that allowed me to have that flexibility because I'd go, you know, 12 weeks where I'd be doing a 9-day fortnight and then, you know, a 6-week break where I'd be back to full time. And then I've got another subject, so I'm back to a 9-day fortnight. So I'm not sure anyone knew what I was up to, but, you know, it was nice to have that arrangement in place.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge with the, like, the career change, you know, if you're doing it in your 30s or your 40s or whatnot. Like, life's busy for you anyway. Maybe you've got kids, maybe you don't have kids, but whatever, you're just going to have a busy life. I think the 20-something-year-olds that are doing the university degree and then they come out and life's a whole lot simpler in your early to mid-20s than maybe it is in your mid-30s or your mid-40s to then try and fit in the studying. It's also you've learned if you're in your early 20s and you've kind of gone through high school and straight into uni and you don't know any different. It's just you continue on. Whereas if you've had a 10-year break or a 20-year break between the last time that I studied to when I'm doing this career change stuff, it's pretty time-consuming as you're just explaining now.
Yeah, and I remember back at uni, I was only doing 12 contact hours a week and that's all I was doing. I was working more hours in my part-time job than I was actually at uni. So then coming back to it now and going, I'm working full-time and I need to find time to do this study. And in the office I was in, I was actually working with accountants and there was a few girls there doing their CPA and they would work a full day and then they'd go home and study at nighttime. And I was just like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Like my brain just wouldn't have taken in any information. So it's also figuring out how that study workload now works for you based on your circumstances because, you know, I just couldn't imagine, you know, putting kids to bed and then pulling up the computer and trying to study. Like I know people have done it. I know a lot of people have done
it. Lots of people do. You know, I couldn't do it.
No, it's crazy.
I got through most of my studies when I was still living at home with mum and dad and there was a 45-minute train ride from mum and dad's house into the city where I still work now. And this was back in the day when it's all PDFs now, but back then when I was doing it, they'd send you a folder of notes. And so I'd just take like a bundle of pages with me on the train. I would sit in the same seat on the train every morning, the 7:45 train or whatever train it was I was catching in the morning and just sit there reading my notes through. That got through all the reading just on the train to and from work.
And then I'd have to just do the assessments whenever on the weekend or whatnot. But yeah, I was living at home with mum and dad, so it was a bit easier.
What they did was when they changed from sending out those folders, so I know for my diploma subjects I got sent folders.
Yeah.
And then the grad dip, it was all PDFs. So I used to download all the PDFs, combine them into one document, and send them off to Officeworks to get printed and bound. Because I was so at that age that I'm like, I can't read all of this stuff on a computer and, you know, document it and highlight it.
You want to note it up and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I want to note it. I want to turn the corners of the top of the pages so that I know where I've made notes to myself for certain assignments. And I couldn't do that looking at a computer screen. So people were like, what are you doing? And I said, oh, Officeworks prints and binds my notes for each subject. You know, it's a thing I did.
So that first job that you were doing work, you know, trying to get in with those, the young doctors, as you said, that's a lot of other financial advice businesses see that as a, you know, as a good end to building their business. You were just doing insurance advice work, you said, from before we pressed record.
Yeah. So, you know, I had a background in insurance, so I could read a PDS, which I think definitely comes in handy.
Yeah.
But also at that age, like we're talking about people that are early 20s to early 30s, they're really just starting to work and insurance wasn't a way in. So that's how I didn't make the conscious decision to just move into insurance. It's just how it naturally led to doing insurance to supplement the fact that we already had a large insurance book that I was kind of servicing at that point anyway.
Yep. Yep. And is there any crossover between the, I don't imagine there is, but that kind of professional indemnity type insurance that you're doing before and versus the life and income protection, is it? It's two completely separate conversations, isn't it? Two completely different worlds.
Yeah, I went from, so there's four, maybe there's five now in medical indemnity companies. So yes. I would only have to know really my policy. And there's three versions of that depending on what type of work you do. Then I move into life insurance. And at that stage, I think we were still at 11 or 12 insurers. Then you have to know all, so let's say 12 products.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to understand life, TPD, trauma, IP, you know, and then I didn't go into the business insurance, but so you've got four subsets of each type insurer.
Yeah.
It was a lot. And I understand, you know, people who I've met who just are insurance, like their ability to understand those products is, you know, huge. And that's what it needs to be. And it's kind of one of the reasons that I'm kind of like, you have to do just insurance or don't do it at all. Like dabbling in insurance, I think, is a risk to clients. But then I also understand if you're a solo advisor, you may not have a choice.
Got to do it all. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So then in the last year or two, you moved across to Pollock Financial. What are you, did you move across there initially doing insurance only? Did things change for you? What happened?
I made a conscious decision to step out from where I was. And I had about a 4-month break in between coming over. And during that time, it was more about what have I done in the advice space? What haven't I done in the advice space and where do I want to be? The where do I want to be question still probably hasn't been answered because I'm still trying to figure that out. But the what I hadn't done part really was the retiree space. So coming into that space, I had some technical knowledge behind me, but definitely no practical advice experience in this space. So I was really just hunting for a firm that was happy to take on someone and work with me to get that knowledge and service a client book. Luckily for me, I've spent a lot of my time networking up here in Brisbane and, you know, a few people were very happy to connect me to other people. And that's how I ended up here at Pollock. They had been looking for an associate to replace an advisor who had left. And had realized with the size of the book that they have that they really did need an advisor. This is how I've ended up changing from insurance to retirees. And I now feel like I've lost a lot of insurance knowledge because I'm just not using it on a daily basis.
It would go fast, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you, you moved into Pollock, was that to take over a client base from someone that, had left? So there was a some clients there for you on day one?
Yeah. So Pollock, from my understanding, works quite differently to most advice practices.
Right.
There's not a book per advisor. We have a combined book, which we all service, which meant, stepping in on day one, there's a whole lot of clients already here that, you know, I could, you know, start making contact with. And how we're done is that, you know, each month we get allocated the clients are going to see for their reviews and also the clients that you're going to contact for their phone contact. And, you know, we just rotate through the clients. You know, some of the clients have, you know, self-managed super funds and are quite complex. And at the moment, that's well outside of my skill base. So I usually don't have a lot of contact with those clients, but there's a lot of clients in the self-funded retirees or, you know, part pension clients who, you know, I enjoy spending time with and getting to know. And that's where most of my clients are. So there's probably, you know, over half of our client base would definitely be in that space.
Yep.
And that's who I'm seeing at the moment.
So with that, are you interested in the model that you're following there? So there's one big group of clients that everyone kind of looks after. So you mentioned, you know, you allocated certain ones to see for the month for reviews and so forth. Do you then get allocated that same person the next time, or could they end up with a different advisor for the next review? How does that work?
So the idea is that they would see the practice principal at least once every 3 years, just so that they've got, you know, the reminder of who owns the business and, you know, who's making sure all of this happens.
Yeah.
And then it would depend. So, you know, it might be that I do the review, I do the phone contact, and then next year one of the other advisors does the annual review. But, yeah, we do like to have at least probably two people having oversight on that client.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's three. But, yeah, there will be cases, yeah, it might be 18 months that the only contact might be me before they have a review with someone else.
Yeah, that's a really interesting model. I've never come across that before.
It was very surprising to me when I started here, because my understanding and the limit of understanding I had was that most practices work where, you know, James, you have a book of your clients and you're the only one that sees
clients
them.
And I look after them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So file notes.
Yeah.
What's going through my head is how do you continue that client story on? Like, because there's always things that you're going to have the interaction with the client during the meeting. They're going to talk about certain things that will make their way into your file notes that you'll make from the meeting. And there's other things that won't. They're just the general chit chat. But that general chit chat kind of continues on. Like, how do you keep that client story going? And if it's someone else that meets them next time, how do you deal with that? What do you do?
Look, the clients are very used to this model.
Yeah.
So that works massively in anyone's favor for who's coming in. But you do spend a lot of time in your preparation actually going over last year's file note.
Yep.
And picking up those nuances about, so you traveled here last year. How was your trip? Were you doing renovations? Or are you still out cycling? Like, you do try and pick up those nuances so you can build that relationship and continue that conversation. It does mean, sometimes things get missed or aren't touched on as much as they probably should be.
Yep.
But for the most part, you can get enough out of the advisor's notes or the contact for the last 12 months to see what their story is and where they're going. It takes a lot of practice to be able to make sure you're writing so that the next person knows what's going on. And that's part of what I've been learning as well.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the mindset that you'd have to write your notes in, or if you're recording them, or however you're doing a file note, whatever that looks like. Yeah, you just have to have that mindset to say someone else may pick this up the next time. So you'd have to be extra diligent, which then means your files are then that much more robust. So they're probably, you know, one of the most amazing client files out there. Auditors probably love it because it'd be so much of a story in there. But, for your colleagues, so to make their life easier and continue that relationship with the clients.
Yeah, we talk really about when we do file notes, what does, you know, what does future Kathy need to remember from this conversation to be able to pick it up the next, you know, in 12 months' time? Because you're right, if I don't speak to them for 12 months, what do I need to remember that I've had the conversation about to be able to continue the conversation or for someone else to continue the conversation? So, yeah, it's taken some time. We've actually just gone to recording our meetings. So then we're having to take extra time with file notes because we're finding that some of those nuances aren't coming through in our outputs. So,
yeah, right. Okay.
We're retraining ourselves as well to use the technology, but also to make sure that, again, it's an output that's usable in 12 months' time.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that. Often we're just studying the whole, you know, recording and AI file notes and all the rest of it. And we've gone with like an in-house thing. There's a guy that works in the business that's kind of built it using all the Microsoft tools and so forth. And I'm reading and going, wow, like there's so much in here. Like it's all the conversation that we had, but it's just picking up so much that I probably wouldn't have put in my file notes beforehand. To the point where I'm kind of saying, oh, well, I don't even need to worry about it. It's hard to kind of break that connection of I need to be scribbling notes whilst I'm talking to Kathy because I need to write a file note later and just trust that the machine will do it for me.
Correct. And that's the hardest thing because most of our meetings are scribbling file notes because you want to remember what you're talking about later.
Yeah.
And then now all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, do I need to write that down because of we're recording? Isn't it just going to tell me what I said and put it in a file note for me? Like, where's the balance now going to be?
Yeah.
Because, some days I do feel like I'm the, you know, your GP. And your GP is always distracted typing stuff and writing stuff out, not actually talking to you. And I'm always conscious of that the client is here to talk to me, not to watch me write notes down.
Not watch you type or write notes down.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with new client work in the business then? Like, does that come through like one channel? Like, do you do new client work? What does that look like?
That's a controversial topic at the moment. New clients, it depends on what we can understand about their complexity before they come in. So if we've got someone who's pre-retiree or just retiree, they just have basic, you know, pension, might be age pension eligible, and that's all, you know, they're not a complicated. They do come into my calendar. If we're starting to get more complex with self-managed to find additional investment properties, yada, 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 then they will probably go off to my colleagues. I have not had a lot of experience doing new business in retirees, mate.
Yeah.
And it's a different thing to do. So I am finding it a little bit more challenging at the moment, especially I'm someone who wants to educate and help someone as opposed to I want you to sign on the dotted line and you need advice. So I'm having to balance my personal need of, you know, educating and helping someone to you need advice and you know, you're going to have to pay for that advice, not just me being helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but would the idea then be, so you would go through you or any of your colleagues, if it went with someone else, you'd go through a new business process, a new client process, whatever that may look like for you. And then at the end of that, if that client's due for a review next year, it may not necessarily be you that's doing the review with them.
Yeah. And that's a conversation we have pretty early on.
Yeah.
The way we also, you know, talk about our FSG, we actually present all three business cards from the advisor with our FSG. So they're already aware of who the three advisors are. We also try and make a point that when we do our confirmation call to say that everything's been implemented, it's usually not the advisor who's done the advice. It's usually a different advisor who makes that call. So therefore, that advisor is already introducing themselves. Then usually, you know, the next phone call after that will probably usually be the third advisor. So in that first 12 months, they are getting exposure to all three advisors so that when they do come back in for their review, they're more comfortable with the fact that it might be someone else. Some clients do have preferences and if it's a very strong preference, then they usually get allocated to the one advisor. But we are trying to reduce the number of clients that have those preferences.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with like the point of contact? So the client's got a query, they need a little bit of extra money or something's happened with their age pension and Centrelink. In most businesses, they would go to the advisor or the associate advisor or so, you know, their little team within the broader business.
Yeah.
How does that point of contact work with Pollock?
So we got a free support staff. But for example, my first probably five to six months was every time the phone call came in for a withdrawal, it went to me. And I would have the conversation with the client about doing the withdrawal, and all the, you know, then pass it back to the support team to do the implementation. So that also helped my exposure to the book because, you know, clients in retirement often are spending money. So, you know, there was a lot of conversations in that space. We can usually pick up from who the client is what level of conversation might need to be had and allocate it that way. But any straightforward withdrawals, and usually calls about age pension, or, hey, Kathy, I updated it. Can you check that that's happened? Again, it's who's available. But, yeah, there are some phone calls that I'll be like, look, not me, pass it to someone else.
Yeah. But that goes, so the clients then, do they call the central office number for those things? What about email communication? Is there one central email that they send inquiries to and then they get split up amongst the advisors?
So we actually, as a team of six, all have access to each other's inbox.
Oh, right. Okay.
So today someone's on leave. If they get a direct email, we'll probably check the email maybe twice today. We can actually respond to that email, answer the query, call them, whatever it is that needs to be done. So from that manner, clients know whoever they email, someone's going to see it and pick it up and respond to it.
Yep.
Which, so there is a central email, but clients don't use it. Because if I've emailed a client, they're very likely just to email me back.
Right back, yeah.
If I'm not here, someone will pick that up and run with it. And then when I come back from leave, that email's been dealt with. So in some ways, it's nice to walk back in after leave knowing that someone's been monitoring your inbox. Mm.
It's a really interesting business model to kind of talk about because you hear a lot of stories about advisors getting, you know, they hit a capacity and they can look after 100 clients or 150 or whatever and then that's it. And then you have, you know, this issue that happens from time to time, an advisor leaves for whatever reason, you know, okay, who's going to look after these 150 clients? And then there can be in some businesses like the owner, the founder, the principal, whatever you want to call them, that they, you know, it was their business and they brought on all of these new clients and eventually they get capped out of capacity. How do you then continue to show up for those clients in some capacity, but then also service more than just 100 that you're capped with? And this is a really interesting solution to that.
And I'm not sure if this came out of both Adrian, the principal, and Andrew, my colleague, are both ex-CBA. And I don't know how CBA ran their advice business, whether they did this kind of, you know, it was just a pool.
Yeah.
But it definitely, from what I can see, created very sticky clients.
Yeah.
Because the clients are sticking to the business, not necessarily sticking just to one advisor. And it's a conversation I've had, you know, with friends of mine who are advisors who are going on maternity leave. And I say to them, but what happens to your book? And they're like, oh, well, I've divvied this to this and this to this.
Yeah,
and
split up.
Yeah. And I said, well, but what happens when you come back? Like, how? Do you take the book back? Do you have to rebuild? Like, you know, it kind of in some ways shocks me that you can be building a book, take time out of the workplace, and when you come back, that book may not be come back to you in the same fashion.
Yeah. And there's also the business risk on the other side. As an owner of a business, you're supporting someone and they're building up this book of business. And then all of a sudden they leave and they either set up their own business or they go and work down the road. And then 6 months later, they've set out their non-compete period and then all of a sudden all the clients leave and go down the road there. So it does protect the business that little bit more. You know, as you said, they're sticky to the business, not necessarily sticky to Kathy because they're spoken to so many people over the
time. Correct. And I think,
interesting.
I think in the time that I've been here, most of the people who have left have been through debt and a very, very small number of people who are at that point that they really don't have the funds to continue paying for advice. You know, and that's going to happen in any business. Like, you have to have a price point that minimum matches what the cost is. And unfortunately, that doesn't work for everybody. So I haven't really seen, I don't think I've seen anyone that's actually left to go to another advisor.
Yeah, amazing.
Which is, you know, you would have probably expected it if it was a book, because there's, you know, personnel changes that make it, that's possible.
Yeah. So I'm interested in how you're going about learning and kind of whether there's some coaching or training or something just around working with these pre-retiree and retiree clients. So you sound like, you know, your earlier days in financial advice were working with 20-something and 30-something-year-old doctors and so forth, just starting out in their career, very different stage of life to the 60-year-old that's retiring.
Yeah.
How have you gone about upskilling, and what's the support like at Pollock, and have you learned about it?
I think I've been very blessed to land where I am, and I knew that I needed to be somewhere that they take an approach to educating, you know, their staff and working with new advisors. I knew that the advisor who had left had been here in client support, para planning, associate, and moved into advisor. So I knew they had capacity to be able to train someone into that space. So my first probably 4 weeks was learning how they do their admin processing, because, as you know, being a small firm, you kind of need to know everything just in case you need to know it. You know, if someone's not here, things still need to happen. So how do they do their back office? Then I moved into, you know, doing review phone calls, which is really just checking in what's happening since we last spoke. Have you followed up all of these things that we chatted about? How's that looking? And part of it was introducing myself. I sat in on a lot of client meetings in the first 3-4 months. I'd sit in on anything that I could fit into my schedule. I wrote a lot of file notes, because at that stage we weren't recording. So my job was sitting in on a meeting and coming out and writing the file note, drafting any client communication that had to go out. But spending a lot of time, had two very different advisors to learn from, but they're all about making sure I'm comfortable. And, you know, even during my first meeting, they're like, you've spoken to this client, are you happy to do this? You know, ask me any questions before you go in. So making sure that at each point I felt as though I could ask any question and that, you know, I was ready. I probably ran my first client meeting, I'm going to say, February or March last year. So they didn't just pick me up and throw me in, which I know a lot of places do, because they should already have the knowledge, you know, and already be ready to go. But no, they were happy to be patient and to get me to a point that I was comfortable doing it.
It's the classic, you hire the right person, as in you, for you being you and the attributes about you. You can learn about the age pension, you can learn about pensions and retirement, like, you know, you learnt all about insurances before. You can learn the things that are relevant to the 60-something-year-old, but they're hiring you for you and your personality and the way that you engage with clients and all the rest of it. Those kind of, hard things and soft things, or whatever, however it's described.
Yeah.
Because you can learn the rest. And it's really great that you've had the opportunity. You know, there are a couple of other advisors there to shadow both of them. I talk to, there's a lot of young advisors in the business where I work, and I'm always encouraging them to, just because you're doing your PY, for example, with one advisor, like your supervisor, doesn't mean you need to go to all of the meetings with that person. Like, you're going to learn so much from going to meetings with other people. But the rules are the rules. You know, superannuation law, it is what it is. But just the way that you interact with the clients and the way that you explain it to clients, you're going to pick up different things from different people to work out how to do it for yourself.
And I think that, you know, the big thing that, you know, they talk to me about during my interview is that they are very much about who the person is. You know, are they open to learning? Are they someone, you know, that can understand rules but then apply them to each circumstance? They've also got someone coming in, you know, as a female advisor, I'm not sure if the stats at the moment are we're 1 in 5 or 1 in 6.
Yeah, very small number.
Yeah, basically a little number. That is a completely different skill set, communication set, to what they've experienced in the past. I've had it with clients, which, you know, I don't expect, but you have clients who are like, Kathy, I hate coming to these meetings because they were so boring. They had only ever talked to my husband, not to me. And I just felt like I was sitting here for no reason. And I finally feel like I'm learning something. And these are people, you know, I always think of my clients like I'm talking to my mum.
Yeah.
Because they're that demographic. And I'm like, if I can teach my mum things about her pension, then I can teach our client something about what they're doing at the moment. So, yeah, they did bring me in for who I am. And they use that to their advantage. Like, don't get me wrong. There are definitely clients that are like, oh, Kathy, like, can you just take this client? Because she loves a chat and we don't have time for her. So take all the times you need so that we don't have to sit in on the meeting.
Yeah. So playing to everyone's strengths. It's good.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
So do you think do you have a desire to kind of get into some of the more complex stuff? Like you mentioned at the start, you're doing some of the simpler things maybe at the moment, or you're happy playing in that space?
It's really still a hard question for me to answer. And I have been kind of thinking about it, you know, as to where do I go next? Because there's a natural instinct for me to help people, a natural instinct for me to want to be with people on their journey, which is one of the reasons that I changed into advice to begin with, because you do work with your clients, not just at one point in time, but, you know, they're selling a house, they've had grandchildren, they're buying a car. Like there's so many things that you get to be part of. So do I want to go into more complex advice? Still don't know. Do I want to sit just doing, you know, people who only get the age pension and they need help with that? Don't know. Like I'm still at this stage trying to figure out exactly where I'm going to sit. And obviously the team here has ideas about that. Which they've let me know. I'm still kind of working through that.
Yeah, I reckon you'll just naturally pick it up slowly over time. You know, you've got to learn the simple stuff first before you can learn the complex stuff. Yes, it's just kind of the natural progression. But
and I think that's
it'll just
the thing.
Slightly happen without you consciously trying for it. I think it will just slowly happen over the coming years.
I think the other thing is that at the moment, I've got so much learning and so much going on that I'm not aspiring to that next level of anything at the moment because I still want to be, you know, completely comfortable and competent in the area that I'm doing before, you know, taking, you know, a leap into something else, which I know there's a lot of people out there who are very ambitious. I look at my colleagues writing books, hosting podcasts, doing all these things and going, am I doing enough? And have to remind myself that we're all contributing in our own ways.
Yeah.
But if we all write books, there's no space on the shelf to sell them. So,
true.
Yeah.
Only a small number of people that buy books. So, I normally kind of finish with what's next for you, but you've kind of just been talking about that. You're still working it out.
Yeah. Look, I'm very happy here. I've gone from working from home to full time in the office. So I've had some big changes, but you know, the situation and the role that I've got here works for me for now. And I hope that continues, you know, for an extended period. That's what everyone wants. And I think that's what I'm going to look forward to and hold on to for the next, you know, 12, 18 months and see where we go from there.
Perfect. Well, look, thanks, Kathy. Thank you for joining me today and glad that we could reschedule this and get the podcast done. It's been good getting to know you. Thanks for joining me.
You're most welcome.